I'm Jonathan Green. This is Lost and Found. This week, Copenhagen, part two.
Last week, we had an homage to Smørrebrød, visited the Totes OTT Expressionist Church, and indulged in a hoogie polemic. It was a pretty comprehensive account of the Danish capital. I think most people would say that. But no, not here. Our commitment at Lost and Found to elaboration demands we go deeper. Now, last week, we left our very Danish guide, Juliana Engberg, bemoaning the Noma-inspired proliferation of muscle reduction and praising the bike culture for which the city is famed. Juliana, is it time to get on a bike?
I thought that we would pop on a boat, actually, Jonathan, because what is nice to do here in Copenhagen is to go up the waterways. It's a good opportunity for you to see some of the really cool, interesting architecture that's popped up over the past decade or 15 years or so. For instance, the magnificent opera building, which you can see over there, big black kind of structure with a lot of atrium lighting, the new architecture, the box building, which is designed to house experimentation and conversations about design and buildings, and very much, you know, looking toward an ecologically led set of solutions for urbanism and small spaces. And then we will glide past. It's coming soon. We will see the Little Mermaid.
Oh, look.
She's very tiny, isn't she? She's so small. You didn't expect her to be so unmonumental. But let's face it, she is just a mermaid after all. Look, the poor lass. There she sits on her rock, and she's been doing so since around 1908, I think. But she's had a pretty patchy history. People keep taking her head off. It's a grim trend in Denmark, actually, if we think of recent times. But, you know, there is something about her that really compels people to be vandals. And it's really a little bit unfair. It's such a nice story. It's such a gentle tale. And to engender such sort of antagonism strikes me as very odd. But there it is. You know, she's fine. Fortunately, she's got her head on at the moment, which is nice. She also gets... It is a relief. She gets a bit graffiti every now and then too. Look, it's also one of those funny things about Denmark. They are a little bit inclined to make statues of fictional people. So in a very different city, Helsingborg, which of course is sort of fictitiously the home of Hamlet, you will find quite a lot of statues of Hamlet and his mother. and various other sort of characters are dotted here, there and everywhere around in Denmark, built upon these ideas that are coming from their storytellers, such as Hans Christian Andersen, of course. But it's intriguing. I mean, especially the one of Hamlet, which is not a true person and really a person created by an Englishman, Shakespeare. But there you go. You have to get your statues where you may. Anyway, I think the thing is we won't pop into Noma for the reduction of anything. I think what we might do is just pop down the road a little bit and go to one of the fantastic contemporary eating halls that they really excel in here, where we can get a lot of cool street food at a really, really modest price and see where all of the young people are.
That's a big, sort of exciting space.
It's a great space. It's a converted, you know, warehouse, of course. There's much of this kind of architecture over here. I think it's good, to be truthful, that, you know, Copenhagen is preserving some of these older buildings while it is progressing toward the more contemporary style. So it's making it's a rather nice patina of space, Copenhagen. It has in the last 20 years or so, I think, gradually become the metropolis it thought it was. It's much more go ahead now. It's much more outward looking. It's much more cosmopolitan, if one can say that, in its demographic structure as well. And really that's quite nice because Denmark can be a little bit homogenized. And so in Copenhagen you feel as though it is a place that has joined to the rest of Europe. Of course, it's very much wedded also across the way and quite easily to Sweden, to Malmö, which of course is why they made those terrific series about murders that take places on bridges and cut people in half. Yes. Another dismemberment. Oh my God, it's like a plague of dismemberment, really.
Yes, dismemberment
intrigue, damaged detectives. What is it about the Danish psychological landscape that has produced this morbid fetish? And with it, some excellent TV drama. To answer that question, I need an expert. Sue Turnbull is a senior professor of communication and media at the University of Wollongong. She's also the chair of BAD, the Sydney Crime Festival. Sue, can you explain how a city as delightful as Copenhagen has given rise to such a dark genre?
Well, I've been to Copenhagen on multiple occasions now, and it's a very, very beautiful city. And of course, you know, Denmark is a social welfare state and with a strong public service broadcasting tradition. And, you know, it looks pretty good from the outside. But of course, as in all kind of advanced economies, there are all these fissures and cracks and things going on beneath the surface, political corruption, big multinationals moving in. Mm. And so, as in all countries, when you start to kind of look at a city closely, you begin to see the dark underside.
I wonder if, we have this sort of fantasy view of Scandi culture and the great cities of Scandinavia, of their social sophistication, of their sense of equity and social support, but perhaps they are cultures sophisticated enough to be fully aware of that dark side of the cracks, that it's not as papered over as it might be in other places.
I think that's absolutely true. And that tradition of criticizing the society, the Scandinavian society, of course, actually begins in the 1960s and 70s with the two Swedish writers, Per Wallo and Maj Sjöwall, if my pronunciation is probably terrible about that, but these two writers, who were in turn influenced by Georges Simenon and Ed McBain in the US, decided they were going to write a series of 10 police procedurals from a Marxist perspective. They were journalists, they were critical of the society, and they thought crime fiction was the way to do this. So the Scandi-noir tradition of crime fiction, which kind of begins in Sweden and then follows through with Henning Mankell and, of course, Stieg Larsson in 2005, that's been extremely influential in crime fiction. And then what you have in Denmark is the arrival of crime television series beginning. And of course, Australia was way ahead of the game. We were ahead of the UK in spotting the potential of Danish TV crime series because we were watching Unit 1 and The Eagle around about 2001 because the buyer at SBS had seen them and fallen in love with them. And it was her passion for those series that introduced them to SBS.
It's, so it's before, just like Australia and ABBA all over again.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so by the time The Killing came along, you know, we had Scandi crime fiction, and then we had this emerging Danish TV crime series. And The Killing was when the world really noticed the Danish television crime drama, and Australia was ahead. We'd seen it on SBS in 2010, but it was when it appeared on the BBC Four in the UK that everybody noticed, and it really went off in the UK. You know, most memorably, the fact that Sarah Lund gave Camilla Parker Bowles a Pharaoh's sweater because she was such a fan of the show. So everybody suddenly sat up and went, "What is going on?" And The Killing focused attention on this very dark, rather wonderful TV crime drama with this female character as the policewoman with problems, with a problem with son and with some sort of problem with emotionally connecting. And then it this atmosphere of darkness and threat and the look of Nordic noir, as it was called, which of course harked back to film noir, which was where those two connections started to be made.
Except with a sort of a bleak modernism about it, which I suspect as much tells us a bit about the place. I mean, what does The Killing tell us about Copenhagen as a city?
Oddly enough, I don't think the city figures in any immediate way. It's to me, it's more about the interiors. And I became immediately fascinated by the killing, by the interiors, by how people were living in these spaces and how dark they were. And once the bridge actually appeared, I became even more fascinated because you had that combination of going from Denmark to Sweden across the Öresund Bridge. And I've actually done that trip myself now several times. And the way in which these two countries are so proximate and yet really quite different and send each other up.
The bridge you have mentioned and the bridge and the killing are sort of the great pair of programs that take us into this world. Can we dip a bit more deeply, and you've mentioned the connection, the bridge being the physical manifestation of it, between Denmark and Sweden, and the points of difference that we might find there?
Well, there's a wonderful moment in the bridge where the Danish detective travels over to Sweden and he's bought Danish pastries. And there's a sort of debate about, you know, the wonderfulness of Danish pastries by the Swedes, but the Swedes are sort of very off-putting. And he seems to be the warm, enthusiastic, beer-drinking, affable Dane versus the very cool, remote, withholding Swedes. And that's set up in that series in ways that if you don't know that difference, you don't get the joke. And, you know, we're talking about slightly different language and we're talking about age-old tensions between two countries whose histories differ quite profoundly.
Now, before Sorge Noren and her 1977 Porsche made that bridge famous, it was already an important symbolic and structural feature of the Scandi landscape. Colin Bissett.
Bridges are more than they may at first seem, as the one over the Öresund Strait amply demonstrates. It was built to link Sweden to Denmark and thereby plug Scandinavia into the transit network of Europe. The bridge itself is one of the world's most beautiful, the concrete piers which support the road and rail decks stepping lightly across the Öresund for some 8 kilometres. When it reaches the man-made island of Pebbeholm, now a nature reserve, the road and railway then plunge into an underwater tunnel for the next 8 kilometres before emerging in Copenhagen itself. The idea of a permanent crossing here had been mooted since engineering advances made the idea possible, but the project only got off the ground, so to speak, in 1991. 9 years later, the Queen of Denmark and the King of Sweden inaugurated its opening. The reason for the tunnel section was its proximity to Copenhagen Airport on the Danish shoreline, while also allowing an unencumbered passage for ships. But as we know from our beloved Scandi Noir programmes, ships do collide with the bridge's supports, and corpses are often found lying half in Sweden, half in Denmark, inviting the interaction of both countries' police forces. While that may be fantasy, bridges of all sorts always stimulate the imagination. The idea of building a structure not only over but in water provokes a sense of wonder. In this case, there were unexploded World War II bombs lying on the seabed, which added even more complications to those of icy water and swift currents. There's also the knowledge that you can now sweep so easily from one land to another, so long as you can afford the one-way 50 euro toll, when previously this could only usually be done by boat. New possibilities open up, just as this crossing brought new wealth to the regions on both sides of the strait. Better yet is just how thrillingly beautiful the Öresund Bridge is, with its gentle curve and a suspension section in the middle that forms the most elegant gateway that ships can, if they're careful, sail through. In winter, with dangerous ice flows in the water and the whole structure often obliterated by sea mist and cloud, it seems as ephemeral as a dream. But that's the magic of a bridge, that it might be logically engineered and totally man-made, but it inspires something greater in the mind's eye, as though giving us a superhuman power to move over water. This crossing adds the further symbolism of being a handshake between neighbouring countries, an enduring icon of partnership. Building bridges might be murder, but there's always beauty on the flip side.
All this travelling over water, I think it's time for a trip on it. Uta Juncker, she's a travel writer and podcaster. Where are you taking me?
So this is, we're heading to Amager Island, and this is, and we can hop on, I love the Danes, we can hop on what they call the harbour bus, which is what we would call a ferry.
I like a harbour bus. It's very endearing.
And so on this part of Amager Island is, like many cities, Copenhagen has, you know, land that used to be the old industrial land. There's one island in particular which I love is called Paper Island, because it's where the newspaper producers used to store the paper before it went to the factory. And doesn't that just feel like a 20th century artifact?
It does.
But what I love is, like, you know, we got some spare post-industrial land, we put a casino on it. The Danes, they get creative. On one spot here, they've got a power plant that generates power by burning waste. This is located in the middle of a semi-residential area. It's a really big building. And the reason that the design is like that, A, the waste it generates is, you know, it's the cleanest on earth because it's got 700 emissions filtering processes and things. But the designers said, okay, look, it needs to be, we're going to have to go vertical because we've got the smoke and the chimney and everything. And but they went a step beyond and they went, you know what we don't have in Denmark? We don't have mountains. And so, so they created an incinerator that is a waste processing plant, that is an electricity generating plant, that is also a mountain. And they've put on grass and they've put on hiking trails and they have put on a ski slope. It's just wonderful. And there's this other thing they've got, and I use the word thing because I don't really know how to describe this structure. It's, the name is Kurvebod. And I'll start with the problem that they had, which was that one bank of the harbour here, from midday on, it was in total shadow. And they went, well, we want people to use the waterfront, but they're not using the waterfront because it's cold and miserable. So they built out into the harbour this series of platforms and promenades that are sort of all different kind of heights. So you can go and stand at one point and you'll be 5 meters above the water, and you can go and stand on another point and you can dangle your feet in the water. And it's basically creating an outdoor space on the water in the sun. It's fantastic.
Oh, fantastic indeed, but that's probably enough water-related, dismemberment-related sightseeing for the time being. Juliana, oh, I need some art.
Look, I'm going to take you to a little house museum that not everybody would necessarily go to first, but I think if you're in Copenhagen, it is really one of the gems. It's called the David Collection. Christian Ludwig David was a very interesting character. He was a banker, put a lot of, you know, effort into his collecting, and in particular, he was extremely drawn to the Islamic artworks, and it is a sensational collection of Islamic works, small miniatures, carvings, all manner of things, and actually a fantastic way to grapple with the extent to which there are many, many different elements to the Muslim religion and the way in which it has grown up and it has dispersed and it has diverged from itself into different sorts of directions. Mm. It's really a great museum to visit. And then upstairs, I think we might have a quick look at his modern collection, where he has some very significant examples of Hammershøi. He's a terrific artist and kind of a little bit better known these days, I think perhaps due to the fact that Michael Palin, of, you know, Monty Python fame, became extremely devoted to his work and in fact made a documentary. So if our listeners wish, I think I'm sure they could probably go find that. But Hammershøi is very well known for his very subdued, quiet, pensive almost interior scenes with women predominantly with their backs turned to the viewer. They have a sort of lovely meditative quality about them. Very tonal, blacks, whites and greys. Very mysterious work, verging on the surreal, but certainly before that time. An artist with a rather unique vision, I think, Kamal Shoaib. So I think the combination of him and the Islamic is really something superb, to tempt anyone to go there. And I would do that before I went perhaps to some of the other places that are a little bit more famous. But I think that we probably should go to the Neue Karlsberg Gibliothek because it really is a treat. Like the name suggests, it is a place given over to much sculpture because Jacobson, who was the creator of Karlsberg, was particularly fond of sculpture, and you will be able to go into rooms that have a lot of Greco-Roman statues, beautifully put out and created in spaces that are well designed to give them the gloss and the sort of seduction quality that you want. And then we might spend a little bit of time lingering in the Winter Garden, which is just a terrific place to be, especially during the cooler months. They have lovely concerts here, which I enjoy coming to. It's a very nice, warm, kind of almost exotic, what could one say, you know, almost Mediterranean.
Well, it has palms, for goodness sake.
Yes, it's got palms, it's got arms. It's terrific. It's really, really lovely. The other thing that is cool about the Gibliothek is they've added a new wing sometime a little while ago, and they do have a fabulous collection of Gauguin, if you're into Gauguin, and some other impressionists and some of the post-impressionist work. It's a really fine collection and of works that people may not know so well. It's not the usual suspects that you see from the Gare d'Orsay in Paris, say. These are sort of more intimate pictures often, because Gauguin was married to a Dane, and so he had this interesting connection to the place, which sometimes people are not aware of.
But Hammershoy to Gauguin is quite a journey.
It's quite a journey aesthetically, but they are a similar time frame, but, you know, incredibly different, very unique aesthetics, both of them.
Very peckish at this point. Uta, before our time is up, please take me out to dinner.
All right, because near Kuvebod, we're then near the meatpacking district. And here there is, this is just one place to eat after another. And I find it feels a little bit exciting because the thing in Copenhagen, most of the restaurants are beautiful. They're Nordic design, they're clean and they're airy and they're lovely. And meatpacking districts, a lot of these places are a little bit grungy and it just feels so exciting. So there's all kinds of places you can go. There's, you know, there's brew pubs. There's a place I love called Fleisch, which is the German word for meat, which is a butcher and a restaurant. But the place I want to take you to is a Fiskebar, which is a fish bar. So Kodbuen's Fish Bar, or Kodbuen's Fiskebar, if you're saying it in Danish. Because the other thing about Copenhagen, I mean, it's a city on the water. The seafood here is fantastic. Razor clams are what I particularly recommend. And you can sit there and you've got that briny smell of the sea in your nostrils and you're tucking into this beautiful, freshly grilled seafood and you just think, there's actually nowhere else you want to be in the world right now.
Nowhere else in the world you'd want to be, and never more true than these travel-restricted times. We can but dream. You've been listening to Lost and Found, Copenhagen, Part 2. Check out Part 1 on the ABC Listen app. You heard from Juliana Engberg, curator, author of En Route, Sue Turnbull, senior professor, communication and media at the University of Wollongong, Colin Bissett, design writer, and Uta Juncker, travel writer and podcaster. Producers are Mira Adler-Gillies and Lisa DeVissi. Technical production by Matthew Crawford. I'm Jonathan Green.